WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome to Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I'll be your host for the next, close to 2 hours. We have a great show lined up for you this evening, starting with the first hour. The first hour is the mayoral hour. It's not technically an hour. It's more like 40 minutes, but we will feature two of the South Shore's mayors. Starting after traffic, we'll speak with Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter. We'll get a chance to catch up with the mayor. The mayor recently down in Washington, D.C. for the U.S. Mayor's Conference, and we'll get a chance to find out some of the things the mayor was able to come away from, some of the information he was able to get from the conference and how he'll apply it in the City of Champions. Then at 6:40, we have Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund, and we'll check in with the mayor on a couple of different things. And most important, we'll get an update on the compressor station. That, of course, is a hot-button topic as the citizens and some of the elected officials in Weymouth have been fighting that project. We'll also talk a little bit about the Tufts Library, which I believe that went out to bid, and anything else that the mayor wants to touch upon in regards to his tenure as the mayor. After 7 o'clock, we check in with Alex Bazanson. Alex was recently elected as the chairman of the Plymouth County Democratic League. We'll get his take on some of the initiatives he'll try to enact as the chair and some of the things he'll do to kind of mobilize the Democrats here on the South Shore. And then we are going to close things out with Roy Paul. Roy Paul is the executive director of Sensibility Incorporated. And what they do is they teach financial literacy, kind of helping folks kind of get up to speed when it comes to their finances. So we look forward to talking with Mr. Paul. Again, great conversation. And just a reminder, if in fact you have to step away for at any time during our program or get out of your vehicle, whatever you're doing, you can always find our podcast, which are located on the WATD homepage, 959WATD.com. And right there on the homepage, I think it's you scroll down on the left-hand side, click on our banner, the Monday Night Talk banner, and you'll be able to see some of our latest podcasts. I think last I checked, we have well over 900 podcasts that are up that have been posted over the past 8 years that I've been host of this fantastic program. So I ask you, you get a chance to check out some of the shows, whether most recent shows or even checking out our archives, please feel free to do so. Well, we are rolling into the WATD Traffic Center as traffic is being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at BrennanSmokeShopMA.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now Pope's Island, New Bedford.
Well, thanks, Kevin. It's all brake lights and headlights on the expressway southbound. It's just inching along from the tunnel down past South Bay, and you're back in it from Granite Ave down to the split. Northbound slow passing Neponset Circle. Route 3 South stop and go coming off the expressway, but it breaks free quickly, and it stays good down through the South Shore. The northbound side is good. The Bourne and Sagamore bridges are delay-free, but Route 24 South backed up a bit coming down from 128, and Route 44 is good. This report is sponsored by Compassion International. You can change the world for a child in extreme poverty through Compassion International. Just text CHILD to 83393 to find out how. Traffic on the 9s every morning. I'm Lisa DiMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop, and I've got some great ideas for Valentine's Day. Brennan's sells the market's leading male and female enhancement products. Think about it. What says I love you in a bigger way than max size, longer, firmer, fuller? Ever spend a night with a Black Panther? Time, size, stamina. Wow. You'll be saying, go Rhino 30X all night long. And when you get tired, we even have the aphrodisiac water for the ladies. If you were ever curious whether or not these supplements really work, trust me, they do. They have the Mal and Jeff seal of approval. Not that we need them. It's just bigger, better, stronger, longer, faster, harder, more massive than it ever was. Brennan Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford. Brennan Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must be 21 years of age or older. Proper ID is required.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, and joining us for this segment is Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter. Mayor Carpenter is one of many of the South Shore mayors who's kind enough to do a regular segment on here just to kind of keep folks in the region up to date as to what is going on in their area, knowing that we also are broadcasting on 1460 AM, formerly WBET, formerly WXBR. I think it was even formerly where it was just 1460 AM. You and I were on the air that day.
Yeah.
When there was a 10-hour cease and desist because we were, I think we were WBZB or something like that.
For one day, or a portion of a day.
But Mayor Bill Carpenter is here. Mayor, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Great to be here on Monday Night Talk, and thanks for the invitation, Kevin.
I thought it was probably pertinent to have you on because I usually follow what you're doing, and as I do a lot of our elected officials. You recently took a nice trip down to D.C. I believe it was a mayor's conference.
Right. U.S. Conference of Mayors winter meeting. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is probably the most prominent of the national associations of mayors. This was my sixth consecutive year attending as mayor. My first trip, I'd been mayor, I think, for about 2 weeks when I attended. But it's just a great opportunity to have access to officials and experts that normally on your own as an individual you would not. It's a great opportunity to also network with other mayors from around the country, because what's really interesting, what I've learned over the years, is that it really doesn't matter what part of the country you're from or whether you're a large city or a small city or we're considered a mid-sized city. The primary issues that mayors are worried about and are priorities to mayors are pretty universal. All mayors want to create jobs. All mayors want good public schools. All mayors want safe neighborhoods. All mayors want to get guns and drugs off the streets of their cities. So the big stuff is pretty universal. And whether you're from California, Texas, or Brockton, Massachusetts, we're all facing a lot of the same challenges. And then we all have our own parochial interests, too. But the big stuff is pretty universal. And, immigration right now is an issue in most American cities. We have all these topics. So I think it's just a great opportunity to the U.S. Conference of Mayors. It's a three-day conference every January in D.C. Again, this year I came back with some new ideas and some great networking with other mayors, and particularly you develop relationships with mayors once you're in for a while over the years. So it was a very positive experience.
Talk to me about some of the methods and trends that were being shared this year. What was some of the main topics and conversations that were had?
Sure. I think probably two of the most meaningful workshops, the smaller sessions that I went to, one would be on gun violence. Certainly, like any city, we are devoting all the resources we can to getting illegal guns off the streets of our city and to reducing violent crime in general, and particularly gun violence. So there was a great session there with perspectives of a number of cities from around the country. There was some part of it was devoted to these high-profile mass shootings that have occurred. Not during that session, but I think because of that session, I actually had an opportunity in D.C. to get to know the Parkland, Florida mayor, who has roots from West Roxbury many years ago. And actually I sat with her for dinner one night and really got a little different perspective on Parkland than just what you read in the national news, and particularly from a mayor's standpoint. And, you know, those are the types of conversations you would normally never get to have. So I think the gun violence and strategies to reduce gun violence and listening to some of the experts from around the country was very valuable to me. And, of course, something, Kevin, you and I talk about all the time is the opioid crisis, the opioid addiction crisis that, you know, frankly, impacts every community in Massachusetts. And whether you're Duxbury or Brockton, we've all been devastated by the opioid addiction crisis. And I don't know if it's good or bad, but, you know, Brockton has been recognized nationally as a leader with some of the strategies that we've employed as some of our response to the crisis. So we had a great session, and we're going to be working more with this. This year, the U.S. Conference of Mayors Substance Abuse and Recovery Task Force, which I am very privileged to sit on, it's co-chaired by Marty Walsh and the mayor of Dayton, Ohio, Nan Whaley, but I sit on that task force with them. Well, we merged our meeting this year with the Workforce Development Committee because we really wanted to put together the strategies that we've got to put more emphasis on longer-term recovery and continuum of care. And, you know, this fight against the opioid crisis is not just about getting people into detox. I think that's a big misconception of the public. Someone comes out of a four-day detox, what I always say to people is, now we have the opportunity to have a conversation with someone who is not under the influence of drugs at that moment. But we know that real long-term recovery takes a long-term commitment. But a key part of long-term recovery, as we continue to work with people, is being able to get a decent job. And so we've got to make part of this journey through recovery that we're providing job skills training, workforce development, job placement, so that we can help position someone for long-term recovery where they can get a livable wage job. Because, man, if you can't make a living, what are your odds of staying clean, and what are your odds of relapse? And so I thought that was a great working session. I brought back a lot. I actually met with my director of social services right after getting back, and this is going to be the focus of our next mayor's task force meeting in Brockton, is to, you know, we've got to incorporate jobs, we've got to incorporate safe and sober housing into a plan for recovery.
It's interesting you say that, and you humbly saying that you're part of this task force, but let's not forget when Governor Baker came into office that you were part of a traveling working group, yeah, that went around the state along with Plymouth County Sheriff Joe McDonald and many, yeah, others who sat on that board, yeah, to try to gather information. And let's also not forget that the city of Brockton, taking parts of the design of what the Gloucester police chief did, and was able to create the Champion Plan. Can we get a small update on the Champion Plan?
Sure.
How's that doing,
yeah,
these days?
The Champion Plan is incredible. And, you know, we talk about this workforce development job skills. we're at the point now with the champion plan, we think we're doing really well at what we do, but we need to keep pushing the envelope. We need to continue to be a leader, because there are probably a couple hundred police departments around the country now doing some form of police-assisted recovery. But in terms of the champion plan, in our first 2.5 years, we helped over 1,000 people get into overnight drug treatment programs. About half of those folks were not Brockton residents. We are helping everybody that we can for as long as we have the capacity. We have places where there are very successful programs like East Bridgewater with EB Hope, Plymouth. I just recently met with the police chiefs of East Bridgewater and Plymouth because they're sending people to the champion plan. They don't quite have the capacity to do it all by themselves, so they're referring people in need of services to the champion plan, and to the best of our capacity, we're going to continue to help people because, as we say, this is a regional crisis. It's a statewide crisis. I was very fortunate to be selected by Governor Baker to be on his opioid working group, and Sheriff McDonald and I were the only two elected officials that served on that group, and that experience way back now, that was about 3.5 years ago, but that experience reminded me that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew, and that we've got to keep learning, we've got to keep sharing best practices, we've got to keep breaking new frontiers. And I think that I think we can get this turned around. But, you know, fentanyl has been devastating in Brockton and throughout the whole region.
Okay, I was speaking with Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter. He is our guest for this particular segment of Monday Night Talk. And again, just a reminder, if you have missed any portion of this segment, this show, or past shows, it's as easy as visiting our WATD homepage, 959WATD.com, and look for the Monday Night Talk banner. Click on it, and you will find a cornucopia of Monday Night Talk podcast. Digressing back to the mayor's conference, I'm usually, again, always kind of peeking at a lot of the elected officials and folks in our areas, what they're doing. And I know that you had a chance to meet with members of the congressional delegation.
Yep.
What is on your list of things when you were able to get with a Congressman Lynch or a Senator Markey? What is the first things out of your mouth?
Well, generally, on this trip, Senator Warren was actually back here in Massachusetts while I was down there, but I did meet with Senator Markey and Congressman Steve Lynch, and those are meetings we hold down in D.C. 3 to 4 times a year, and they can be wide-ranging. You know, we're always looking for, as a city like Brockton, we're looking for opportunities where there may be some federal funding available, where we may be able to get support from our congressional delegation. I think this year a big topic with both of them was infrastructure. It looks like despite the stalemate going on down in D.C., that once they get back in business, this infrastructure may be one thing that the Republicans and Democrats might actually be able to work together on in D.C. I think they're all in favor of infrastructure investment. They don't agree on how to pay for it. But in this new Democratic Congress, this has been good for Brockton, and I think for Massachusetts, where our federal delegation is almost entirely Democrats. So Congressman Lynch is getting some new committee assignments that are very influential, and one of them is on the infrastructure subcommittee. So I came back home, and we're already working on potential infrastructure projects in terms of design and proposal. In the event that federal money should become available at some point in the future, we're going to be ready to present some projects for funding.
And is this strictly just straight-out funding, or is this for grant opportunities?
Well, this would be... Well, we don't know what the final version will look like.
Okay.
But I think we do believe that the federal government is going to put billions of dollars into the infrastructure of this country.
Okay.
We're lobbying hard for that money to come down to the local level, because I think the people that know what's best for Marshfield are the Marshfield town officials. I think the Brockton city officials know what our critical needs are. And so we really need to convince at the federal level not to just send the money out to states, but to actually allow individual cities and towns to To file projects for consideration. And that's part of what we lobby about. And so we talk about everything. And, you know, Senator Markey and Congressman Lynch have been both great on the opioid crisis. They've both worked on this for years with us. And so, you know, we look for federal issues that might impact the city of Brockton and at the same time get updated as to what might be going on down there, particularly this year. You know, a lot of the conversation I was interested in the latest in their perspective on the shutdown. At the time I was there, Washington was shut down, and that if that were to happen again, it is going to affect local governments.
What do you have in downtown Brockton that would have been affected by the shutdown? Anything?
Not immediately, but then if things start happening, like people's benefits start getting impacted. We don't have a lot of federal offices in Brockton. We do have a regional Social Security office in the city, but it's also services. In a place like Brockton, we've worked very hard to build working relationships with federal law enforcement agencies who, you know, we bring together federal, state, and local, all working together on various joint investigations in Brockton. And we rely upon those federal agencies with the resources that they can bring to a particular investigation. And I would love, I'll tell you one thing that I probably shouldn't share publicly, but, you know, I lobbied both Senator Markey and Congressman Lynch that if there were an opportunity in the future for one of our regional New England, Boston-based federal law enforcement agencies to locate an office in downtown Brockton, I think that would make a lot of sense. We do have a presence of those agencies here. A number of years ago, the FBI opened an office in downtown Chelsea. It was critical to the revitalization of their downtown. And right now, the FBI has an office in Lakeville. And Lakeville is a very lovely town, but I don't
not
know.
Not a lot of need.
Yeah, but I don't know that the FBI office being there has any impact. However, if you took that same FBI office and put it next to the DA in downtown Brockton, yeah, it would have a heck of an impact, as the DA's new building has had there. So I try to get down to see our delegation 3 to 4 times a year. I think it's critical. And, you know, folks will say, well, you know, the congressman and the senator come back to Massachusetts all the time. You can see him here. But what it allows us to do is build relationships with their Washington staffs, and particularly their chiefs of staffs. When I visited with Senator Markey, he had probably 4 of his staff members in the room, and he also had the Massachusetts office on the speakerphone. Mm-hmm. So it's not just access to the official himself, but it's the staff, because when we have a problem, when we're calling down for help, you know, Steve Lynch is not answering his own phone down there. We're dealing with the staff, and particularly, say, an example with Congressman Lynch. Kevin Ryan has been his chief of staff since day one, and Kevin Ryan knows how to negotiate his way through the federal bureaucracy. And you know, if we pick up the phone and we call Kevin looking for some help, it's not a voice on a phone from someone he's never met. It's the voice on the phone is someone that's a friend that has been down to visit regularly, and we believe that helps our chances of getting assistance from D.C.
Help me kind of just spawn an analogy to our listeners. It's like having a plant. You can water the top of the plant, but where the water really is needed is the roots.
That's right.
And if you're able, and if there is a relationship with the staff and they know who you are going to get more, you're going to have a higher rate of success in getting past the gatekeepers and being able to have that FaceTime or conversation with the elected official.
And clearly, you know, Senator Markey and Congressman Lynch have great Massachusetts offices that we also absolutely work with. Of course, our old friend from here, Jim Cantwell, now heads up Senator Markey's Massachusetts operation, and we stay in touch with Jim regularly also. But I don't think you can replace the occasional visit with the legislator and their staff down in D.C.
Anything you want to say, and just to kind of wrap up our segment here on Monday Night Talk? And again, we thank you for coming in and joining us. Anything you want to say?
Well, I think folks here in your ATD listening area, I hope that they will really pay attention to what happens in Brockton in 2019, because You know, myself being a native of Marshfield, I know that folks out in the suburbs tend to have a certain perception of the city of Brockton, but the reality is changing a lot, and the reality is changing quickly. And we have $150 million of new development that's going to break ground in Brockton during 2019, both public and private. And so please, just as we're transforming Brockton over the next 12 to 24 months, perhaps watch what we're doing, and perhaps we might change your ideas in terms of the type of 21st century city that Brockton will become.
Thank you for being our guest.
Great. Great to be here on Monday Night Talk, Kevin. Thank you.
Right, there he is, Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter, our guest. We're going to step aside, and more Monday Night Talk coming up in just a few moments here on 95.9 and 1460 AM WATD.
Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McWiggins Pub is a fashionable, upscale Irish pub in downtown Whitman. The pub's charming ambience is the perfect setting for Valentine's dinner with your sweetheart. Start with appetizers like the Whitman Sampler for two with potato skins, fried pickles, onion rings, chicken tenders, and mozzarella sticks. McWiggins' menu offers everything from steak tips to shepherd's pie to the best pizzas on the South Shore. And of course, they have Guinness on tap. McWiggins Pub is now accepting reservations for Valentine's Day. Call 781-447-7333 today to reserve a romantic dinner for Valentine's Day. And coming soon, the patio at McWiggins Pub.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk.
All right, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, and joining us as part of our Mayor's Hour, we have, of course, the original host of Monday Night Talk, now Mayor of Weymouth, Robert Hedlund. Mayor, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Hi, Kev.
How are you, sir?
Good.
Hey, I gotta ask you something, and I didn't ask you the last time I chatted with you. I saw something really nifty that you did on a show called Ask the Mayor. Now, I didn't realize that cloning technology had made it down to the municipal level, but somehow you were able to interview yourself on WETC. How did that happen?
My host of the show, whose technical name is actually, title that he has is Citizen Advocate / Inquisitor. He claims he was stuck in traffic on the North Shore, but upon some investigation, we determined that he actually forgot that we were taping that day. So we didn't have anyone to ask me the questions, so I basically asked them of myself for a while. And they're sent in by our viewers and our residents who send in. It's pretty good. We don't script the show. I don't see the questions. I mean, I might glance at them as we're about to go on the air, but I don't see them. We don't prep for them. We make it very impromptu, which makes it more, you know, interesting for me and interesting, I think, for the viewers. So that's how that kind of happened.
Oh, well,
I can't reveal the technical secrets, I guess, that the local cable company employs. You'd have to ask them about that.
Okay. I actually know them, but that's okay. I won't reveal. I will not pull the curtain back so folks can see who's
behind
it.
I know you come from that world.
Yes. So I just wanted to commend you. I thought it was a nifty little piece, and it was very innovative as well.
Yeah, that was fun. If it didn't take longer to do, I think that might be the route I should go every month. We tape two episodes a month.
Well, it's a fantastic outlet to be able to kind of get the word out as to some of the things that are going on in your great community. I think I want to start off with where do things stand? I know a longstanding project, the compressor station, is still something that's ongoing. Any updates or any news on that you want to discuss for a few moments?
Yeah, I mean, the recent news obviously wasn't good with the Baker administration issuing an air quality permit. It was one of a couple of areas where the state really has any say and control in this process. Obviously, most of the decision-making process in siting a facility like this lies with the federal government, specifically the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they're basically a tool of the gas industry, and they have since they were created in 1938. So we were, you know, very, very disappointed that the governor interpreted. I mean, we were appreciative of the fact that the governor ordered health impact assessment before he was to look at the issuance of the air quality permit. But we thought there was enough information in the health assessment that was done to give him cause to not issue the air quality permit. He sees it differently. We had a meeting with him, local mayors and I had a meeting with him a week and a half ago, a couple weeks ago, and you know, he laid out for us his rationale. Don't agree with it, but you know, we understand where he was coming from. We just don't agree with it.
Is this still
that's a big issue? Actually, we had a follow up with him because in the letter that he sent us back in July of 17, when he informed us that he was going to do the air quality health impact assessment, he also indicated he was going to do a public safety study. And we had some local meetings with his secretary of public safety at the time and all local public safety officials who presented a lot of information on this. And we reminded him that basically disappeared. So we reminded him of that. So he ordered that be completed. But unfortunately, in the area of public safety, that really falls under the purview of FERC also at the federal level.
Mm.
So there's a couple other issues I won't get into. They're a little bit arcane, but there are a couple other angles that we suggested the governor look at, and not suggested, requested that he look at. Some flawed reporting that was done by the gas company on the suitability of the site as it relates to our waterways regulations. We're asking him to look at that. And we have had or either concluded or ongoing, we've had seven different legal actions filed against the gas company in various venues, from D.C. Circuit to the First Circuit, Massachusetts courts, administrative filings we've done in waterways at Department of Environmental Protection, wetlands at DEP, et cetera. So, you know, we've been fighting this on all fronts, and it's a David and Goliath situation, obviously.
Would you say that there's still teeth in the fight to be able to at least hold off this project until something substantive can be uncovered to halt it in its tracks completely?
Well, the gas company wanted to be pumping gas, I think, over a year ago, you know, but the actions that we've taken have delayed them significantly. They won't be still pumping gas through there anytime soon. And, you know, the opponents of this project, some have differing reasons for opposing it. I personally, and I think the other two mayors would agree with me, that you know, we think that natural gas certainly is a part of our energy supply mix here. Appreciate the fact that the governor is doing some things to work to bringing energy costs down, because we pay some of the highest natural gas prices in the country. But this does nothing, this project, proposed project, does nothing to help us locally with our gas supply, but it does place a facility like this in a location that they've never been sited in. So that's why all the controversy for people who might be listening that haven't been following it very closely.
not to transition away from that, unless there's anything else. I mean, is there anything that's upcoming that residents and folks regionally should be paying attention to in regards to this fight?
Well, if you have concerns, you know, letting the governor know of your concerns is helpful because, you know, there's going to be a couple things that come back on his plate here as a result of what we're pushing, specifically, you know, as it relates to the DEP issues surrounding a flawed 21E that was done on the site when the gas company acquired it. The public safety study, which is huge, but again, that's the governor can't reject it on public safety grounds, but we certainly want him to be enlightened. And we have an issue with issuance of the waterways permit. That's a site that falls under what's known as a water-dependent use, and it's supposed to be retained for water-dependent use or public benefit, you know, parkland, et cetera. And this is going to be the first compressor station that's sited on first delivery compressor station, I should say, not a production compressor station, but the first, because there are some out in the bayou in Louisiana, but the first real delivery system compressor station that's sited in a designated port area on the waterfront, not to mention in a densely populated neighborhood. So people have concerns, call the governor's office, say, you know, what are you doing down here endangering the health and well-being of a lot of residents on the South Shore? We just saw that gas explosion, up in Michigan a couple days ago. We've seen, you know, a couple of them around the country in recent years. One of these, if this compressor station here goes, it's putting a lot of people's lives in danger, not to mention the fact that it would probably level that new $300 million bridge that's sitting on top of it. It will sit on top of it.
Speaking of the governor, we know that we're just a few short weeks since he put forth his fiscal 20 budget. Have you had a chance to get a gander at it, speak with Senator O'Connell or anybody like that in regards to what provisions are in it that might be beneficial to your community?
Yeah, we're just still now taking a look at it, but obviously the thing that interests most is what it means for local aid and education aid. The mixed bag, you know, big thing for us is our Chapter 70 numbers, which I think it comes out to $20 a student or something. The increase doesn't keep up with cost. Our charter school reimbursement, we're in an area under the charter school reimbursement formula that we really get penalized in a sense because of the demographics that we face. You know, we're in this category that we don't get much of a reimbursement on charter school students, and we do lose a lot because of the proximity to the South Shore Charter School. So those are the two big issues we got our eye on. But again, you know, we kind of put it in perspective in that traditionally the governor's House 1 budget submission, you know, is really the start of that whole budget debate and discussion. Things won't be resolved until summer. And generally, by the time the process is over, the Chapter 70 numbers are usually a little better than what the executive branch files, whether it be a Republican or Democrat administration. So we're hopeful that that number will change. But when we put our municipal budget together, we have to base it on what is put forward at the start of the process, because obviously our budget processes don't coincide, and so it's a disappointing starting point, shall we say, as we work to prepare our budget.
How much do you still follow what goes on in the Senate? I know you are very busy as mayor. Do you ever have a chance to keep an eye on some of the things? Because one of the most recent things that came out was from one of your colleagues, Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, who was actually successful in doing some amendments in regards to the Senate rules debate. Have you had a chance to see that?
Yeah, I did follow the rules a little bit. You know, you do a whole show on this because of the trend I saw over the 22 years I was in the Senate. It wasn't a good trend in terms of power being centralized in the hands of one person. It seems like there was a progression every year that every successive Senate president that I saw since Bulger, you know, tried to consolidate more and more power and control, and really, you know, usurp power from the individual members who, you know, under the Senate President, you know, there were issues under Senate President Bulger. Just to give you a comparison, you know, he let debate happen. They worked off a calendar. The committees were empowered. Members of the committees were empowered, and you'd see that. It was reflected in the fact that when you had a committee hearing, everyone was there, you know. And this is a time when the pay was significantly less and would be supposedly evolved into more of a professional full-time legislature over time, but there's less participation over time. Higher pay, less time in debate, less participation at the committee level. Things are more staff-driven. They've added staff on top of staff. So when Senate President Rosenberg took over, and he's someone that had that institutional memory, and he tried to actually reverse that trend, and I think was moving in that direction, and unfortunately he got tripped up and shortly, you know, had to resign because of the scandal that existed in his personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a disappointment, but I have followed that. It's disappointing seeing some of the amendments that were debated that would have provided for more transparency that were debated and defeated. So that strikes a chord with me. I don't follow everything, Kevin. That one I did follow. And, you know, just kind of busy in this job that I certainly don't follow things as much, obviously. And there's not a lot of opportunity to look back because the pace of this particular job is much more significant.
Yeah, we're speaking with Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund, who is our guest for this segment. Mayor, probably one of the final things we'll talk about is, so I guess there was an awarding of a contract in regards to the new Tufts Library that's going to be built. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so we're excited. When I came in 2016, was faced with a huge problem at the Tufts Library, which is pretty much the flagship library for Weymouth. Significant mechanical issues. Before I came in, they were running these giant, ugly temporary air conditioners that were very expensive, that were leased. We had plumbing issues, asbestos problems, mechanical issues, roof. It seems like, you know, the discussion started like, okay, what am I going to do to fix this air conditioning? Well, the roof won't support the new units. You got to fix the roof. Okay, let's fix the roof. Well, no, can't fix the roof because we have asbestos up there. Then we'll have to trigger an abatement of the entire building. Okay, well, then what? Well, then there's some mechanical structural issues with the roof support. So basically, you know, it's a junk building. It was a very inexpensive building when it was built, you know, outlived its usefulness. And one thing that interested me was we were a community that has, of all the communities I represent in the Senate, Weymouth was the one community that had never secured a library construction grant. And I said, you know, if we're going to have to invest this money, why aren't we looking at that grant? And they were just getting ready to wrap up a grant application round. So we circled the wagons real quick. We worked very hard and in great haste, but put together a great application, and we were successful. And council approved our portion. We did it without any kind of debt exclusion request, fit our portion of the spending within our existing capital plan, and got the thing rolling. And we've been on an extremely fast timeline. We're excited about our bids coming in and the projections, and you'll see some demolition start there pretty quick. Abatement work will be starting, you know, immediately, and then once that's done, the demo. So we'll see some activity at the site. And by the way, it's in the middle of a neighborhood that is going through a lot of redevelopment, a lot of investment. We've got a mixed-use project adjacent to this, the private sector. We just we'll put the finishing touches on Weston Park, which is a lighted ball field. So we're reclaiming that neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of miscreant activity at night back there behind the library at this park, rundown buildings along Washington Street. We're seeing the buildings redeveloped. We're seeing the park. We'll have families down there. Some of the new retail down there is going to be an attraction for families that are using the library, using the field. So it's become, once again, it'll become a nice little village center like it once was in the 50s and 60s and beyond.
And
you know, that trend changed in the 70s and started dying out down there, you know.
And when is the completion of the library? What's the date that's been set?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot on that. I want to say, yeah, don't hold me to it, but it'll be in the term of whoever the next mayor is, I think in 2020. I forget the exact month.
That's good to know. Well, listen, we're about at time. Anything else you want to make sure you touch upon while we have you on the program?
Big challenge for us, and probably one of the more momentous decisions in town history. We'll be going before the voters likely in April on a debt exclusion for a new middle school. We're in the mix for the state school building assistance program, mm-hmm. and our voters, our taxpayers are going to have to make a big decision because as a result of a study that the state made us do, we're looking at $100 million just in repairs to this building. It'll be one of the bigger middle schools in the state. So we're seeking debt exclusion override to get that done. We've gone through the process to date, the feasibility study. We're awarded design. We're going through design process now. So that's going to be a big topic of debate in the next few months.
So we're going to have you back on the program so you can have an extended conversation on it.
Excellent.
Well, Mayor, I want to thank you so much. I know you're a busy guy, and you're doing a lot of good things in that community. So we look forward to having you back on. One of these times, we're going to get your fanny back in the chair in studio.
All right, Bob.
Excellent. There he is, Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund, our guest. We are going to step aside. That concludes the first hour of Monday Night Talk. More on the other side here on 95.9 WATD.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
WATD FM Marshfield. WATD Brockton.
McWiggins Pub is a fashionable, upscale Irish pub in downtown Whitman. The pub's charming ambience is the perfect setting for Valentine's dinner with your sweetheart. Start with appetizers like the Whitman Sampler for two with potato skins, fried pickles, onion rings, chicken tenders, and mozzarella sticks. McWiggins' menu offers everything from steak tips to shepherd's pie to the best pizzas on the South Shore. And of course, they have Guinness on tap. McWiggins Pub is now accepting reservations for Valentine's Day. Call 781-447-7333 today to reserve a romantic dinner for Valentine's Day. And coming soon, the patio at McWiggins Pub.
Indeed knows finding the right hire takes time away from your business.
Hiring a qualified data engineer felt like a second job.
More job seekers use Indeed than any other site, so there's no better place to find someone with the skills you're looking for.
I needed someone with a master's in computer science and database experience.
Plus, Indeed screener questions help you find your shortlist fast.
Now I'm back to having just one job.
Get a $50 credit to give your first job posting premium placement at Indeed.com/credit. Terms, conditions, quality standards, and usage limits apply. Additional terms online.
At Simple Mobile, you get the no contract advantage. Unlimited talk and text plus 3 gigabytes of high-speed data now for $20 a month for the first 3 months. Just $20 a month on a lightning-fast 4G LTE nationwide network and no contract. That's our best deal ever. Learn more at SimpleMobile.com. Simple Mobile, out with the old, in with the simple.
Requires new auto re-up enrollment by 3/31/19. $23.75 per month after first 3 months. Credit card and Simple Mobile account required for enrollment. See terms and conditions of service at SimpleMobile.com.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to the second hour of Monday Night Talk. And we got a fun second hour for you, starting with Mr. Alex Bezanson, a great friend to the show, as we've talked about a number of different things over the years, whether it's some of his endeavors to help raise funds as a part of an organization that he and his wife have created called the HUG Foundation, called, you know, the acronym standing for Help Us Give, to being somebody running for office, whether it was for, you know, being on the Board of Selectmen in Abington, to running for state office. And recently, within the past, I want to say, a week and a half, 2 weeks, he was selected to be the chair of the Plymouth County Democratic League. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, congratulations. Correct. Is in order.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If, for folks who don't know, what is it that the league does? What is the priorities of the league?
Well, the priorities are to elect Democrats in Plymouth County, bottom line. And we work with the individual town committees, and, you know, we'll hold classes. We're there to help them with identifying votes, and we're kind of the conduit between the Democratic town committees and the state parties and the bigger campaigns. But it all starts with the grassroots. And my mission as chairman is going to be focusing on grassroots, local elections, and how can I help and how can the league help every one of the 27 towns in Plymouth County elect Democrats on the local level.
Is it a matter of, you know, is there going to be, you know, you look at every year, I think, differently, and what the issues are, how they're affected. Does there have to be a tweak in philosophy when it comes to mobilizing to get out there, to get folks to want to vote for your said candidates?
I think so. I think, I honestly think that a lot of middle-class Americans think that the Democratic Party has begun to abandon them. And I think that was evident when Donald Trump was elected president. I think that's not true, but I think that's the news. That's what's being played at the 6 o'clock news every night. It's more that the Democrats really don't care about the working people, and that's absolutely, positively not true. In my own campaign, I had the endorsement of the entire AFL-CIO and all the unions. And the Democratic Party is the party of the working men and women. And I want to make sure that's known in this district. I think we've gotten away from that in the last few years. I think both sides, Democrat and Republican, have our extremes. I don't agree with everything in my party, but I think it's time we need to get back to the grassroots and that starts at the local level. When I was first appointed to the Conservation Commission in, I believe it was early 1990s, it was John Walsh, who happened to be a selectman in town. He got me involved, and he was actually chairman of Plymouth County Democratic League at one point, and went on to run Deval Patrick's campaign. And, you know, and his message was, knock on doors, it all starts at the local level. And it really does. And that's going to be my mission as chairman.
I have to ask you this, because it's something that I've observed, and I think probably a lot of other people who may not be super active when it comes to the political process or political parties. But if you look at both the Republican and Democratic parties, you're seeing more and more where folks who've been a part of their party for a certain amount of time, they're defined in a certain manner. They seem to trend more so towards the center, where the younger folks who are coming into a particular party seems to be that they are
drifting to the extreme, and it seems like there's nothing to stop them, like a bumper or a wall, to keep them from drifting even further and further. Is there any concern about how far an extreme that you're able to keep the party together, without it imploding because you have two different ideologues?
It is, and that's definitely evident now that there are a lot of younger people that are joining the Democratic Party but are going much farther to the left than I am, honestly. I think most people in this country, though, are either just right of center or just left of center. And I think that's the majority of Americans, but those are not the people that are getting out to vote anymore. And the extremists on both sides are getting out to vote. And believe me, I want to be all-inclusive in the Democratic Party. I'm listening to everyone. I may not agree with everything my party does, but I think the younger people should be heard. I definitely think they should be heard. As a matter of fact, my outreach director will be Llewellyn Lambrose, who worked on John Bradley's campaign. And, you know, we're trying to bring everyone in for the good of the party. But I do think you're seeing that on a national level, that people are doing a good job of getting the younger voters out, getting the majority out. And that's where we saw that in Congress in November.
Well, you look at the Republican Party, and many will probably say, you look at the party was once a whole. Now you have somewhat of a subset of the Republican Party called the Tea Party, which is more extreme right. Any fear that there may be one day where there's going to be an extreme left that will be an offset and renamed? I mean, do you sit and ponder that, or do any of your colleagues?
Well, I think we do have some extreme left-wing members of this party, and that's kind of my point. I did another radio show recently, and that was the topic of discussion, that both sides seem to have gone to the extreme, and that's the news that's being played, like I said, where I honestly believe the average American person is right in the middle, left or right. They're not making the noise. They're not getting out there to vote. It's the extremes on both sides that are doing a great job of getting their people out and voting. And that's why we saw these upsets and very big surprises in the last election. So nope. I think we have to get back to making sure that the average American believes we're for them and get them back out to vote. And I think that will bring the country back together. As long as we have the far right and the far left fighting every single day on the news, this country is going to be further and further divided.
What's the plan? I mean, have you had a chance to sit down and meet with the committee and have conversations to be able to attract new members from all diverse backgrounds, especially if they're Democrats?
Well, since the November election, I have been going around to different town committees, even before I was elected chairman of Plymouth County Dems, and bringing my message that we have to start this grassroots. We have to be an all-inclusive party, but we have to attract everybody and not let anyone think that we're only going one way and not interested in helping the average American. So I've been going around to Democratic town committees doing that. I will be having my first meeting with my executive board, and I have Mark Lindy that was from Brockton that was elected my vice chairman when I was elected chairman. We have Brian Dunn from Plymouth, who was the treasurer, and I mentioned Llewellyn Lambrose from Scituate, who is going to be in charge of outreach. And the executive board consists of one person from each state rep district in Plymouth County. So it's a pretty big board. And we have people from all walks of life and people with all, you know, different political beliefs. And some are further to the left than I am, and some are maybe a little further right than I am. But we're all Democrats, and we want what's best for the average American working people. Yeah. And I think that's going to be my message, and I think that is the message of the Plymouth County Democratic League.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is, and this is just from my own perspective, and, you know, you look at a city like Brockton, which is, a lot of folks see it as like a Democratic stronghold. But if you were to kind of look at the other 26 communities, which are town-based, you have, it's more conservative than it is, say, Democratic.
It is, absolutely. And Plymouth County Democratic League was started in 1935. And it was started because it was a Republican/conservative district at that time. And it wasn't until, I believe, up until the late 50s or early 60s when Democrats finally started getting elected in Plymouth County. And interesting fun fact is Plymouth County Democratic League was formed by John Buckley's grandfather. John Buckley is a register of deeds. And his grandfather formed the Plymouth County Democratic League because he saw way back then that it was a conservative district and that wasn't filling the needs of the Democrats in this area. So we have a proud history of people from Abington being chairman of the Plymouth County Democratic League. I mentioned John Walsh, Jack Buckley Sr., who had a great career in public service as a state rep and worked in the Dukakis administration. So we have a proud history of Democrats in this position in Plymouth County, and we've made great strides in the last few years. We have several elected state representatives and state senators in Plymouth County now. And we want to keep that going because we honestly believe that we are the party of the working men and women.
How often will you invite elected state senators and state representatives to be a part of the meetings to kind of discuss some of the things that they're working on up at the State House?
They will be notified of every one of our meetings. My plan is to have our executive board meeting, and then probably every other month I plan to meet in a different town within Plymouth County, so it's not always in Abington and not always in Plymouth or Marshfield, so we can get different people that may not be able to travel. It is a big district, and we're going to go around to all the Democratic town committees, offer our help. We're going to offer classes if you want to be a candidate and how to run on a local level, and we're there to help them. We're there to help build up the Democratic town committees. And like I said, I will be visiting every single one of them, and we'll be rotating where we meet on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. And each one of those meetings, we hope to have a state rep, a state senator, or an elected official come and speak.
It bodes well for me to ask. So what's your first big ticket event that you're going to want Democrats from all over the county to be a part of?
Well, on March 9th, we have our annual St. Patrick's Day dinner.
Ooh.
And that this year will be held back at the Polish Club. We did it at the Polish Club a couple of years ago, and it was a great success. Last year, we actually had to cancel it because of weather. So I think that was the first time in quite a while that it was canceled. But we're back at the Polish Club on March 9th at 6:30. We will have some statewide elected officials as our featured speakers. We're confirming those now. It's a great time. We have a band, and, you know, if anyone knows Greg Hanley, he'll be up there singing, I'm sure. And we have our Irish dancers coming. Matt McDonough's wife, her Irish dancers will be coming. So it's always a great time. And, you know, even if you're not a Democrat and you want to come, we'll let you buy a ticket and come. You might want to join the party. So it's always a great time. We've had it in several locations over the years, and everyone seems to like the Polish Club, so we're back there this year.
So I would ask you this. So, all right, so you got a big event coming up in March. And listen, I would pay just to see Greg Hanley sing. It's thoroughly entertaining. I will say that. And he's a good friend, so I think I'm allowed to say that. But the general purpose, I mean, what's the focus beyond trying to get more folks mobilized in the Democratic Party locally? Is it a matter of also helping in regards to folks who are seeking office? And is this strictly on the state and national level? Or are you also helping folks who might be looking to run in municipal races?
I think that's part of the focus that has been missed over the years. They've mostly concentrated on state rep and up. I want to change that a little bit. I want to help people run. If they want to run for the Board of Assessors in their town, if they want to run for school committee, or if they want to run for selectmen, I want to help them also, because I firmly believe that that's where it starts. And if we get good people running for a school committee or selectmen, eventually we'll have people with knowledge of how things work and run for state representative or state senator or governor or who knows what. But that's where it starts. Our current lieutenant governor was a selectman, you know, and a lot of our state representatives were selectmen. And I really think that's where it starts. And I want to be a chairman that is there to help at all levels, right from Board of Assessor all the way up to presidency. And we have a big election coming up in 2020. And we have a lot of interest already. And I think there's 6 declared Democratic candidates already.
Wow.
So it's going to be, and I can't name them, so don't ask me, but I know there are about 6.
Okay.
It's going to be a lot of interest, and I want to get the people out to vote. Like I said, I don't think everyone is getting out to vote like they should, and that's going to be my focus as chairman.
Again, we're speaking with Alex Bezanson. Again, great show, great friend to the show, and he was recently elected to the Plymouth County. He's the chair of the Plymouth County Democratic League. And we're kind of just getting some thoughts as to what his vision is, you know, during the time that he'll serve leading that committee, and some of the ideals that he'll look to put forth, or the group will look to put forth, to mobilize folks to get involved. And I like what you said, Alex, in regards to, you know, getting folks to get mobilized and get involved in government at the levels of, you know, running for selectmen. Because one too many times, the one thing that frustrates me, and it's just a personal thing, I like the idea of someone who is gaining knowledge at all levels and is willing to work their way up, starting with municipal government, whether it's they're running for selectmen, they're running for mayor, alderman, whatever the, you know, the name of the top board is, or maybe they serve on the town's finance committee and then decide to run for office before they look to take a graduated step to run for a state office or to run for Congress. You're one of those individuals who, you served on many boards, then you ran, was successful in becoming selectman in Abington before you decided to try to, you know, run for a higher office. And that's just my thought and preference. It's not something that I feel that should be the gospel for everybody, but it's just nice to see that somebody is willing to run for office after they have learned. Because again, if you're going to be up at the state house, you want to have an understanding as to, you know, what's going on the local level in the district that you're serving and some of their needs. And if you served in that capacity, I feel as though what's the word I want to use here? Osmosis, okay, that you're able to gain that information, you're able to learn it, it becomes learned, so that you can focus on the actual needs without trying to learn on the job.
I agree 100%, and that is why I ran last November, because I did have 27 years of municipal experience, 23 years on the Conservation Commission, as a water commissioner, and at the risk of sounding like one of my campaign speeches, but it's true. and I served on the Board of Selectmen. I chose not to run for re-election to focus on running for state representative. Unfortunately, I wasn't successful, but I honestly believe that you need to be involved in local government to exactly what you said, to understand how the process works and what the needs are of the district you're representing. And people can tell you that, but unless you have it firsthand, there's a learning curve there. And I think that that's why I was elected chairman of Plymouth County Democratic League, because they know that I've been in those positions. I've been on volunteer boards. I've been on elected boards. And I know what it's like to run a campaign. I know how to run a campaign. And I think that's why the members elected me, so we can bring that message forward to all the 27 towns within Plymouth County and help people, help younger people start moving in and into these offices. And that's our future. And I think that's, like I said, that's why I was elected to do this.
So I have to ask you this, and I'm asking you in regards to philosophy. Why does it work? Why does what we do up here in Massachusetts, and whether it's on the local level, whether it's the folks who are serving up at the State House, and we know that it's a blue state. You have more Democrats that are elected in the House and in the Senate, but yet all of these individuals are able to work together to be able to create policy and do it without bickering or it being a sound
or
cut.
Or shutting down the Massachusetts government.
or shutting down. why hasn't what we do up here and what's done in the other 50 states around the country, why isn't that something that is resonating down in D.C.? Where's the disconnect, in your opinion?
Well, like I said, I think the national news is a lot to blame for this. They're only publicizing the extremes on both sides, and that's what's newsworthy to them. That's the sound bites that are coming out every day. And I don't believe that's actually what's happening, but it's hurting the negotiations, and it's hurting both sides not being able to get anything done. And I think that's exactly what happened with the shutdown last month. I'm hopeful that they reach some sort of agreement before, I think it's February 21st is the scheduled deadline. But again, I think it's going to take years to change that, but if we work on the local level and the state level and then elect people nationally that have that mindset to work together, and as a selectman, as a water commissioner, I worked with both parties, and I know municipal elections aren't supposed to be biased or political, but they are, But I worked with both sides. And I got some good things done as a selectman. I worked with the Republican selectman. We got dog park. We got the sewer. As I said, I don't want to turn this into a campaign speech because it's not. But I have a history of working with both sides, and I think we need more people that are kind of in the middle that's willing to work with both sides. And even if you are extremist on one side, we all believe the same thing and what's best for the country. And sometimes you have to give a little, and sometimes you take a little. And I think the people in Washington, some of them are just too far dug in now that I'm not sure that's going to happen. I don't think there's any give and take down there. And I'm not sure what the answer is right now.
Okay, we're speaking with Alex Bezanson, who has been our guest for this particular segment of Monday Night Talk. He is the new chair of the Plymouth County Democratic League. Alex, if anybody wants to find out more as to what the league is doing or want to get involved with meetings, want to attend meetings, or even some of the events that you may be holding down the road, is there a way for folks to be better informed?
Sure. The best way is to go to PlymouthCountyDems.org, and you can sign up for membership, or you can sign up just to get newsletters. And you know, we're happy to have you at our meetings, even if you're not a member. You come, you might like it, or go to your local Democratic town committee meeting. And you can probably find that, you know, through your town hall when they meet. Most of them do meet in a town hall or libraries in town. Whitman actually meets in the police station, so they're publicized when the meetings are. And get involved. That's the message I want, is get involved. Whether you're 16 years old, you can register to vote. You can't vote until you're 18, but you can register at 16. And get involved. Get involved in your high school politics. Get involved in local politics. And really get involved no matter what side you're on. Obviously, I'm hoping you join our party, but just get involved. And I think that's what we need. We need more people, younger people involved. And a lot of people just don't want to do it today because of the atmosphere out there.
Well, here's what I liken it to. And I was having an off-air conversation with someone. I liken politics to somebody who is a sports fan, somebody who is fanatical about their team. And you know, it's interesting. It's as if if you're somebody who, you know, loves your team and feels that they can't be beaten. I feel a lot of folks, they may not be sports driven, but when they get involved with politics and if they choose a party, a lot of times they are, you know, they're invested, and that's what's important. If you're looking to get invested, well, you know, maybe check out one of the political parties and see if it's a fit for you, right?
Absolutely, and there's plenty of information online. If you're unenrolled, a lot of people call that independent, but it's actually unenrolled. You're not in either party. You know, you may want to jump in on a party, and people say, well, we can't change anything. You can change it, and if you get involved, you can make changes, and you can make your voices heard, whether it's Democrat or Republican.
There he is. Alex Bezanson, again, has been our guest. Alex, again, you're due to come in a couple of weeks to talk about a great Hug Foundation event. I know the Ice Huggers will be taking to the ice against the Boston Bruin alumni. We'll have an extended conversation about that in probably a couple of weeks, as I said.
Well, let me just give you a little tease. The great Ray Bork and Rick Middleton will be skating in Rockland for the Hug Foundation on March 24th.
All right, so there's no chance that he'll somehow suffer an injury like he did last time.
Well, I'm not skating, so he probably won't.
Okay, that's good news. We'll look forward to that conversation again. Alex has been our guest. We are going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Glass, not Dr. Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Glass. You see, when I was a kid, my dad took me to the doctors. For some reason, I don't remember. I do remember all those certificates, the diplomas, and all of them were written in Latin even. So one day I said, Dad, I'm going to be a doctor. Luckily for the general public, Dad said no. Tiny knows best. And now, I do have an office. And the walls are loaded with certificates. All my auto glass technicians are certified and qualified to do all your windshield repair and replacement. My dad would be very proud of us.
My boys do a good job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
My dad did a great job.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you for keeping your radio dial set here to 95.9 WATD. Of course, also heard on the World Wide Web, 959WATD.com. Our next guest is the head of an organization that kind of helps high school students when it comes to securing their finances in the future. We have Mr. Roy Paul. Roy is the executive director of Sensibility. Roy, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, just your background, if you will.
Sure. My background, I started, I guess you could say, at the age of 19. I was elected to a board of education where I grew up in Middletown, New York, in Orange County. And it really started before that, about 16 years old. I was in high school, and we were prepping for the Regents exams. And the teacher said, I remember it vividly, you have to take this test. It's not a real determinator of what you know, what you will learn in the future, but follow these steps. You'll pass. You never have to think about it again. And I'm sitting there as a student, and I say, well, then why are we taking it? And she said, well, it's a state standard. You have to take it. And then I'm thinking in my head, I didn't say it out loud, that we should just change the state standard.
Mm.
And it just so happened that at that time, there was a statewide movement to increase the cutoff points. Normally, K through 12, in order to pass the test, you need a 65. But with the state Regents exams in New York, so many kids across the state were failing that they lowered the passing grade to 55.
Mm.
More kids would pass. Instead of increasing the standards and, of course, educating students, they just lowered the score you needed to pass so they could say more kids are passing the Regents exams. So I thought that that was a flawed system, and I was protesting against that, and I was becoming very vocal about education issues. And eventually someone said, you know, there's a woman who's retiring from the school board. She's retiring, moving to Florida. You should run for her seat. 18 years old, first year high school, and I first year out of college, and I said, they don't elect 18-year-olds to school board. You've got to have an EdD or a PhD or something, you know, 30 years in education. But then I said to myself, what if I did win? What if? Ran very grassroots campaign. Everyone says grassroots become a very popular term post-Obama. But it really was. It was, you know, palm cards, knocking on doors. It was a very aggressive campaign. A lot of my other students who were in school with me went out, knocked on doors. People never heard of a school board election, didn't know what the school board did. They had kids they sent to school, didn't know what the school board did. And we were educating people about this. And on election night, I won by 26 votes. And that started my five-year term on the school board, and I learned a lot about a lot of different things. But that was my first real foray into, I would say, professional life. After 5 years, I said, I had a wonderful time, but someone else should do this and get elected. And I was transitioning between Middletown, New York, upstate, and New York City. Most young people, they grow up upstate. The first thing they want to do when they get some sense is move down to the city. That's where all the opportunity is. And enrolled in graduate school at the new school, studying media, film, and relations, and had a stint on commentating with ABC News in New York, and I said, I like this. This whole media thing is really fascinating. But I was really drawn to activism and helping people. So I got connected to a nonprofit organization that was advocating for young people in the foster care system and headed up the government relations. And after I did that for a few years, I said, you know what, this is great, but I really want to get back into the policy world, activism. When I was back on the school board, I remember the days of advocating for different policy initiatives. And I thought to myself, what better way than to try to run for office again? So I ran for the New York State Legislature, and I didn't win the seat, but I didn't lose because I learned so many valuable pieces of information. And as I've gotten older, I've learned to really soak in a lot of these statements that people make that sound good, but no one really internalizes. Like, even if you lose, you learn something.
Mm.
And, you know, people say that all the time. Mm. If you don't win, you learn something. It'll be an experience. But try internalizing those thoughts and I did that after this election, and I sat down one day and I said, you know what, I really didn't win the election, but I really didn't lose. I met so many wonderful people on the campaign. I was able to really get my voice out about what I cared about in the community, and I met so many great people. I learned a different way of fundraising as a candidate that I did when I was on the school board, different kind of election. And I said to myself, there are so many different experiences that I now have in my toolbox that I could use, that I could impart on other young people who want to run for office, things that I can tell them that I learned about my campaign. I really did not lose. I gained a whole bunch more. And it ended up turning into my next career at Sensibility, because one of the people that I had known through that experience knew the board chair at Sensibility. And they were looking for an executive director. And they said, you know what, Mont, why don't you put your hat in the ring? And at that point, I had nothing else to do. I didn't win the election, so I had no job. And I said, well, this could either be a really great thing or it could be a really terrible thing. And I put my hat in the ring. The board of directors said, you know what, we actually really think that you've got the kind of experience that we've been looking for, in part fundraising, to grow the organization and scale it. And so I went to my first lesson. My Sensibility, of course, teaches financial literacy.
Right.
And before I took the job, I went and taught a class myself. So I went to this high school. I live in Harlem, and I went to this high school in Brooklyn. And just getting there on the subway was a task because it was so far out. And I'm in this 10th grade, and I want your audience to remember that. It's a 10th grade class. These are students who are 2 years shy of graduating and then entering the real world, whether it's through a vocation, you know, if they don't go to college, they're going to become mechanics or whatever they want to do with their lives. They're really at the cusp at 10th grade. And so I thought, this is really going to be a class that's going to be really on point. I don't have to really teach them. They're going to probably teach me something. So I get in front of this 10th grade class, and we're talking about budgeting. And we're using the 50-30-20 rule, where you take 50% of your expenses on the things you absolutely need to spend your money on, like rent, food, 30% on your wants, going out to the mall or something, hanging out with your friends, and then 20% on savings and debt repayment, you know, student loans or savings for your future. And I say to the class, we have a mock budget up, $50,000 salary. Out of this $50,000, you get this much after they take your taxes out. How much do you think you have to spend on rent, right? One kid raises his hand. They said, you need about $1,200 a month. And that's somewhat reasonable. I mean, you know, there are expensive places in the city, but there are still pockets where $1,200 can get you something. It may not be something luxurious, but you can survive on $1,200 a month in rent, some places, even if you get roommates. But there was this one kid all the way at the back of the classroom, and he raised his hand and said, no, you only need $175. And everyone starts to laugh. And so I said, wait, calm down, wait. Where did you get that number from? I'm curious. And he said, I know you only need $175 because that's what my grandmother pays. She's on Section 8. And that struck me in a lot of different ways because, going back to what I said earlier, this was a 10th grade class. These are kids who are smart enough to know what it means to live in New York City.
Right.
And here I've got this student who says you only need $175 in rent because his grandmother's paying that on Section 8. And it hit me. I said, wait, he doesn't really think, as a 10th grader, that he can grow up, get on Section 8 with his grandmother and pay $175 in rent too, right? That has to be an isolated insulate, and everyone knows that, right? But no, he was very serious, looked at me with a straight face, and then kind of looked at me like I was odd because I was kind of perplexed by this whole thing.
Mm.
And then I had to stop and say, well, let's have a, you know, screw the plan at that point. I said, let's have a conversation about what that means, because that may work in some cases, but that's not something that you are going to have at your disposal. And we had a great conversation because it was a very mixed class. And I had kids telling me about the situations that their parents are on that has, in many cases, crippled them from being able to pursue the kinds of careers that they wanted because they have to help mom or dad pay the rent. Having real serious conversations about money and what that means. And one kid said to me, well, what are you expect us to do? If we have to help our mom pay the rent, how are we going to go to college? It was almost as if no one had ever said to him, these are the options to pursue in order to have upward mobility. He was perplexed at me saying, what am I supposed to do? I have my mom telling me I have to help pay the rent. How do I go to college and do that at the same time?
Mm.
And we have conversations about money all the time, like that one student who knew how much his grandmother was paying. He had an exact number, $175. He knew what program his grandmother was on. She was on Section 8. So there's either he saw something at some point, he overheard something. There's a conversation going on about money. It's just not always the conversations we think
right.
that young people are having with their families when it comes to money. So going back to the founding of Sensibility, ironically, you have Alexa DuPont Bell and John Moore. Alexa is a member of the DuPont family. She and John were both at Harvard Business School, of all places, and despite their access to wealth and opportunity and resources, and of course being at Harvard Business School, their personal finances were in a mess. And she loves to tell this story, and they looked at each other one day and said, wait a second, we shouldn't be here. We've got access to, you know, CPAs and, you know, financial planners. We're at Harvard Business School. How did we get to the point where our personal finances are a mess? And as they were cleaning that up, they said, wait, if we can do this, then can you imagine how other kids, in particular those from low-income communities, would be faring? Because they don't have half the resources we do. We should develop something to give back. And that's how Sensibility was founded. So there are families that have resources, that have personal finance challenges. There are families that don't have resources, but of course are having personal finance challenges. And in this country, we don't really talk about it. There are a number of ways we don't, reasons why we don't talk about it. Because we see the challenges, we don't have it ingrained in our curriculum across the states of America. They're not mandated to be taught in our public schools, certainly not in our high schools.
Mm.
But there are a lot of people benefiting off the fact that there are people in this country who don't have money. And we see them in different spectrums, whether it's in college, it is legal in this country for private institutions to tell John and Sue, you can take out loans for $40,000, $50,000 a year. They know they don't have the money. Their families don't have the money to pay it. And we're hoping that when you graduate, you'll get that job and you can pay back these loans, even if it takes you the next 30, 40 years of your life. But we don't say to them, let's tie that loan to how much you're going to actually make. Why on earth are we saying to people, take out $30,000, $40,000 a year in loans, when the average salary for some of these positions are between $30,000 and $40,000? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's,
so
it,
we,
if ahead, I if I could just interject for half a second, and it's interesting that you say that, knowing that the $40,000 to $50,000 a year is tuition, and all part of that is books, and it's also to be able to stay on campus. And by the time they're done, after 4 years, think of the insurmountable debt that they'll have.
Absolutely. And what's even worse is that for those who are taking up public loans via the government's actually making money off these loans, right?
Yep.
And so what we've done is we've pushed people into desperation, essentially, where they're now, in many cases, taking out credit cards. And this is why we target high schools with Sensibility, because they're going to be taking out credit cards, and many of them, as they struggle through college, use that piece of plastic in ways in which they shouldn't. Right? They take that, you know, they put their books on there, they put food on there, things that they really shouldn't be putting on a credit card that carries over a balance that they really can't keep up with. You know, then they, of course, if they neglect to pay them, end up having terrible credit as they try to get apartments or homes. They can't do that for other reasons or another. And then they get into loan shark companies who then benefit of the fact that this country essentially gave them student loans they couldn't afford, that forced them to get a credit card to pay things off they couldn't have the cash to do. And now they're trying to get predatory loans because how else are they going to get money, because their jobs aren't giving them enough money. So, you know, it's a lot of people are benefiting off the fact that we don't have financial literacy in this country.
Well, if I could ask you this question, and that is, how important is it to start teaching our children young? I know from a young age,
My mom and dad, the bank that we used to go to used to have this ingenious little thing where they had, it was a quarter bank. And so what you would do is, my mom and dad would go to our local bank, and it would be these little fold-out cardboard things that you put quarters in. And once you get so many quarters, you bring it to the bank, and, you know, it was like one of those, it was like a fun way to learn how to save money, and yet it was beneficial going towards financial literacy. And it also motivated me to want to get more quarters and save more money. What can we do in today's day and age that will motivate our youngest, soon-to-be, you know, adult to save money? What can we do that's not so much so gimmicky, but yet it's going to be something that through osmosis they'll learn how to save and be able to be prepared for things they need, whether it's for a new car, whether it's for a higher education, or to be able to get their first apartment?
You were fortunate in that you had a parent who helped you with this and took you to the bank. But I think one of the things that we are learning is that we cannot rely on some learning to come from home.
Right.
The school system has to take responsibility in teaching those principles. Like in the city of New York, for example, they just mandated mental health being taught in the school system because they recognize that this is not being taught at home, and there are lots of mentally ill people in New York City. Kids have to understand what's going on. And it's the same thing when it comes to personal finances. Because it's not ingrained in the curriculum, K-12, we are, I guess, relying on those lessons, banking and saving, to come from home. And we can't do that anymore. We're learning that there are so many young people who are facing debt challenges, and they're not getting access to this information, that the school system has to be responsible for teaching it.
It's interesting you say that, because I've been fortunate, other than being a radio broadcaster, I also do local television. And so I get to interact in the community, whether it's out in the public, whether it's in somewhere in the educational field, whether I'm going to a school to cover an event or some kind of a government meeting. And they have this thing called Credit for Life. I'm sure you've heard of it. But it seems as though when it's happening is on the cusp of these high school students being, you know, set free into society. And it's a great program, because what happens is each one of these individuals, whatever their chosen career is, they're given an amount. Okay, so Johnny, you're going to be a mechanic. That will net you annually $40,000. Now, from this, you need to hit different stations, whether it's for rent, whether it's for health insurance, whether it's for, you know, if you're somebody who wants to go to the gym on a regular basis, if you're going to get a car, you know, and there's some of the kids who are like, oh, I'm going to get a car, and they race over and they get the most expensive car, then realize halfway through the process is that they've blown most of their money on a really nice car and insurance and don't have enough to live on or buy furniture or be able to eat. Should we be looking at financial literacy programs like Credit for Life earlier than the senior year of high school?
Oh, absolutely. And I remember a story when I was working at this one company. A kid came to the boss, and he was frantic and yelling and said, "You didn't give me all the money that I earned." And he showed his check stub, and the boss said, "Well, what's the issue?" And he said, "When I subtracted what I'm supposed to get, this is not it. You owe me more money." What he didn't do was account for the taxes.
Right. Social Security.
That the government takes out of the tax. And it was something so basic, and you go, of course taxes get taken out. But just the mere fact that he didn't know that, and he didn't know how to calculate that, that is inherently part of the problem. If he had Credit for Life, he would be in that situation. But there are very basic things that young people don't know about, basic things that happen with their money. And we need these types of programs to help educate young people so that not only do they know how to calculate the taxes that come out, but they also know how to calculate that number so that when they try to save or budget their expenses, they know how to do that properly.
So talk to me about this sensibility. What are some of the things that you try to institute to help with financial literacy when it comes to our younger people?
Yeah, so, you know, so we have a lot of different principles that we teach. One of them, I mentioned the 50-30-20 rule.
Yep.
to help you as a guidepost. And, you know, each workshop has a lesson plan attached to it where we actually help kids figure this out. So if you say, look, if you've got a $1,000 check, you know, what does 20 of that look, what does 20% look like, and how do you actually calculate that? Because we're finding more and more that a lot of young people, we, you know, we keep thinking they're in high school, they know how to calculate 20% of something, but they don't in many cases. So we actually go through worksheets and we tell them, this is how you calculate, you take the number, you times it by X, Y, Z, so that they really know how to take that money. 42% of Americans don't have a budget. And so that's something that's critical for us. With our college saving module, we really try to educate young people to know what their payment plan is going to be before they sign the dotted line for the loans. Because I talk to teenagers all the time, and I say to them, how many of you guys are going to take out loans? And they all raise their hand, right? And I say, how many of you guys know what your monthly payment's going to be when you graduate? No one seems to know that. I'm waiting for a teenager to tell me they know what their monthly payment's going to be when they graduate. I still haven't been able to find anyone who tells me that. And that's a problem, because then, of course, you go through 4 years, you think everything's hunky-dory, you don't think about it, you get that six-month break period, you may have a job by then, you may not, if you're lucky enough, and then you get that bill, and you go, holy crap, I can't pay $800 a month, where am I going to get this from? Because no one said to you, this is what your monthly payment's going to be, and you didn't ask. And then you get to a point where you're shocked, right? So that's my pet peeve. If you're going to take out loans, then figure it out so that you know when you graduate, if your average salary in this field is $35,000, can you afford your rent using that 50-30-20 rule? It all comes back to our principles. Can you take 50% for your rent, 30% for your wants, and what's that 20%? Can you actually pay back that student loan? Right, it all has to add up if you're going to create a budget. That's why the budget's so important. We want to teach them how to calculate that. So it's, you know, it's not puff and smoke. It's actually saying, can you navigate this so that you can really live a comfortable life? And then I always get the question, well, if I can't afford it, what am I supposed to do? How do I go to college? You have a lot of kids who are going to institutions they really have no business going to, right? Not because they're not smart enough, but because they can't afford it.
Right.
So they go into private institutions that, you know, tuition is $40,000 a year, and their average salary is going to be $30,000. They're coming from a family of four making, you know, $18,000-$20,000. They have no business taking that kind of loan out. There are great community colleges out there. You can get a start, save money to your institutions. You can transfer to four-year institutions, and there are great public institutions, you know, city university systems, state university systems. You don't have to go to a private college if they're certainly not going to give you any grants and scholarships to go there, and take out all of that money when you can simply reduce your loan threshold by just going to a cheaper school. So, you know, that's another thing that I really want people to strongly consider. I started off at a community college. I did my undergraduate at a city university, had a wonderful experience. So there are great opportunities that can come just by going to a cheaper school.
Amen. And again, we're speaking with Roy Paul. He is the executive director of a nonprofit called Sensibility, and we just have him just for a few more minutes. And I want to take this opportunity to at least throw this out there. You know, he's touched upon different things like developing a budget, the impacts of a student loan. He just ended up, you know, this before I started talking here. You know, it makes sense to take a look at your options when it comes to higher education. It doesn't hurt you to go to a community college for 2 years where it's going to be inexpensive, and then finding a way to connect to a 4-year institution to be able to get that desirable degree. Because again, if that's what you're looking for, that's what you're going for. It doesn't have to be of prestige in order for you. I mean, you don't want to incur so much debt that basically, you know, you're in debt for a majority of your life. You can't try to find a way to buy a home down the road. The last question I'll probably ask you, and that is the usage of credit. And I think that's another problem. I, through osmosis, learned the hard way when I got my first credit card for $800. It isn't free money where you just go out there, I'm going to spend all that money. And then you spend the next couple of years paying it down. And hopefully you're paying it on time. You're doing it in a timely manner that you're not incurring, you know, all the fees and penalties. Talk to us about the good versus bad of usage when it comes to credit.
Sure. And the first thing I would say is we get the question all the time, when should we let our youngsters get a credit card? And I watched a segment on this national broadcast. I won't tell you the name of it. I don't want to get sued or anything. And one of the advisors said, I would be okay if youngsters didn't get credit cards until they were 30.
Right.
That's so silly, right? Of course, you can't wait until you're 30 to get a credit card. You need to develop credit earlier. So developing credit is a wonderful thing, especially if you can maintain a good credit score. And you know what that is. A lot of people have credit cards and they don't even know what their credit score is, which is insane to me. But you have to develop good uses of credit, but you also have to know what the bad uses of credit are. And the way that I think about it is, first of all, when you get that credit card, think about the kinds of things that you really want to put on there.
Right.
If you want to go buy a $300 pair of sneakers, is that something that you should put on that credit card that you're going to have to pay that monthly minimum payment for? Or is it something that you might just get the cash and just buy it outright?
Right.
And I think most of the times when people stop and they hold that piece of plastic, they say, this is really not something I should buy. They do it on impulse, right? They're in the jewelry store at the mall and they're walking past. They don't have extra cash on them. They've got the car. They go, I really want to buy these sneakers. I really want this bracelet. And it's the impulse purchase that makes them do it. It's not because they sat there and thought about it and thought it was a wonderful idea. They know it's not a great idea, right? And so most of the times when people are assessing whether or not they should use that card, and I go, if you really had to think about it for 24 hours, would you really do it? And most times they would say no. So think about the things that you really should be putting on there, like, you know, absolute necessities are the things that should go on a credit card if you've got to do it. The things that you need to survive, I would say the things that are in that 50% category, the things you absolutely need to be putting on your credit card if you have to. But if you don't, of course, then use cash. But then again, we say use cash, and that sounds like a great idea because I have an aunt, hopefully she's not going to listen to this, and she loves to go to the casino. But she lives very close to the casino. And so we used to say to her, you go to the casino, you spend all your money. Why don't you just take cash, leave everything else at home, leave your purse at home, and just take a sum of cash and go to the casino. And then when you're done, just go home. You know, just leave it alone. Well, she lives so close to the casino that she takes her cash, she goes to the casino, and when she's done, what does she do? She goes back home, gets more money, and comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So that defeats the purpose. Forget our ideas.
Well, Roy, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for the for the great conversation.
I had so much fun with you.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Well, we'll have to have you back. Definitely have to have you come back and talk more about yourself, the organization, and kind of help and mentor our listeners, our younger. You know what? Actually, not necessarily. I think people of all ages could use a little help when it comes to their finances and knowing how to kind of, you know, spend their money. The 50-30-20 rule. If you will, give folks an idea how they can find out more about you and your organization when it comes to financial literacy.
Yeah, so sensibility.org, sense-stability.org. If you just Google the name, you'll find us. We have some online calculators on there if you want to help calculate monthly payments for different things, what your spending habits are. It's all on our website.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to having you back on again because we will have you back on. You're great as far as conversation and talking about something that's important, and that is financial literacy and knowing, you know, as far as savings go, as far as developing a budget, you know, when you should or shouldn't use a credit card, stuff like that. I think you can't drive the point home enough. And folks, again, Roy Paul has been our guest. Sensibility of sense-ability. Sense spelled sense-ability.org is the website. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time that we have coming up. Stan Blackmer in the game, South Shore Live. Till next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD-FM Marshfield, WATD Brockton.